Hello, beautiful people. I'm excited for this one today. My guest is Chris Williamson, and Chris is the host of the Modern Wisdom podcast. He's interviewed guests like Jordan Peterson, Derek Sivers, Brian Greene. And in this conversation, we spoke about cultivating peace and presence, how to find meaning in your life, and what society needs to do about the divide between young people and the elders. Overall, this was a conversation that I've been looking forward to for quite some time, because if you're listening to this on the day it was released, April 26th, Chris Williamson is someone that, you know, most people won't know. But the thing is, Chris Williamson, in my personal opinion, will be a household name within 5 or 10 years because of his interviews and the way he conducts himself. If you look in his YouTube comment section, you'll find a lot of people comparing Chris Williamson to Joe Rogan. And I don't think they're the same person by any means, but I think the reason why Chris's style resonates so much is because he's able to speak with such eloquence on such a wide array of topics, as you'll see in this conversation. And he is someone that is really just getting started. He is in his, I believe, third year of podcasting, and what he's accomplished is absolutely incredible. He's got over 170,000 subscribers on YouTube. He has got millions and millions of plays, and he is someone who I look to for how to approach this craft. So with all that being said, I really hope you enjoy this conversation. If you have any thoughts or feedback about the episode, let me know on Twitter at @HeyDannyMiranda. Looking forward to hearing from you and looking forward to your perspective on this episode with Chris Williamson.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
So, Chris, first of all, thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure, man. Nice to be here.
Hell yeah. So, one of the things that I've said to you via DMs before is that what I love about your style is the peace and presence you bring to a conversation. I'm curious how you've developed that.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I haven't always been a massively peaceful person. I think I was quite chaotic for a long time, quite neurotic, quite anxious, and I kind of needed to find a solution to that. And developing just a calm inner world, the texture of my mind, just trying to get that to be a little bit more under control, perhaps manifests when I speak as well. But yeah, it's interesting growing up as a guy, because you have all of these hormones floating around in you, making you aggressive and making you upset and making you all manner of different things. And then you kind of get towards the end of your 20s. I've seen this with a lot of my friends and myself. And you kind of, all that stuff starts to just sizzle out a bit. You've kind of boiled off the sauce that you didn't need, and you're left with the stuff that kind of matters. And I was very fortunate that after being on reality TV and doing some other stuff, that my intellectual awakening was aligned with Jordan Peterson and Joe Rogan and Sam Harris and everyone really getting up to speed. And I admire them. I admire their ability to be calm under pressure, to remain composed. I like being precise with my speech. I like being erudite and talking about things in that kind of a way. And it meant that I was learning from people that are like that. And like, look at any of the debates or the discussions that they get into, Jordan Peterson with Kathy Newman, or Ben Shapiro when he does his Young Conservatives of America talks. They focus on remaining calm because I think it facilitates them thinking more clearly. And I didn't mean to, but if that's the end result that I've come up with, if I'm some poor man's version of those guys at this stage of my career, then I'll take that as a win.
Yeah. And so I think one part of that must be meditation and must be the inquiry practices you've said you've done in the past. What does that look like?
Right now, my meditation is following Shinzen Jung's 5 Ways to Know Yourself. It's a free PDF that anybody can download on the internet. And it is the most thorough insight into the way that your mind works that I think I've ever found from a mindfulness perspective. I spend 15 minutes a day on a morning as part of my morning routine doing unguided meditation, just noticing when my mind has become distracted, labeling the kind of distraction. So it's either see, hear, or feel. It's a visual sensation, it's an auditory internal monologue, or it's something somatic. It's either an emotion or it's a sensation in the body. That's it. Those are the only 3 things that you have. Then you have concentration, clarity, and equanimity. So how much can I focus on the things I'm trying to focus on? How deeply can I focus on the things I'm trying to focus on? And then how quickly can I fall back into an equanimous state if I fall out of it? And that's it. That's all that there is to meditation in the particular style that I'm doing. And you become very aware of the texture of your own mind. You notice when you become anxious or angry or upset or resentful or bitter or anything. You just notice when it changes. And if I get no closer to nirvana than simply being aware when something has happened in my mind, I'm going to call meditation a win for me.
So I think you've done either 1,000 hours or 1,000 straight days, something crazy like that. So this is you after 1,000 days. What was the first 20 days or the first 3 months of you meditating? What was that?
Yeah, so I'd done Headspace. I'd done a lot of guided stuff before. It's probably up to 1,200 maybe or 1,500 days, I guess, overall. I don't think that my external demeanor has changed massively from the meditation. I think it's changed a lot from having conversations, because when you're talking to people, you have to deal with externally how your internal emotions want to manifest. So I'm talking to you and maybe you say a thing that makes me feel self-conscious, or maybe you say a thing that makes me feel angry, or maybe you say a thing that makes me feel encouraged and excited. So the demeanor is practiced when you're doing a thing, when you're conversing with someone, but the meditation has facilitated more the way that I can sense how I feel when I'm going about my day-to-day business, what my inner monologue is like. So at the beginning of it, man, I was very lost, I think. The person that I was 5 years ago is incredibly different to the person that stands before you now, and I'm more different internally than externally. So the environment that my mind exists within, and this is the same for everybody, anyone that's listening, if you are constantly swept away by the next thought that comes careening into view, you're not in control. That's what it's like to be dreaming without knowing that you're dreaming, but you're awake. The difference is that the dreams you have when you're asleep are ones that don't have anything to do with the real world, and those dreams that you have when you're awake are where you're walking around your normal day-to-day business. So yeah, I was a very different guy. I was very neurotic. I was very caught up in petty concerns. And my concerns are still neurotic and petty, but they're now scaled up and away from that. They're less neurotic and less petty. They're just, I have a little bit more control.
What's an example of that?
So a lot of comparison, for instance. I would be thinking about something that's going to happen with the business. So I run club nights. Club nights are a notoriously chaotic industry to be in. And inevitably something would happen. The DJ decks would stop working, or the glass collectors would have turned up late, or whatever it might be. There'd be some sort of catastrophe. And I would emotionally be swept along by that situation. It wouldn't just be stimulus response. There would be an internalizing of what's happening. And again, people that are listening, think to situations you encounter with your spouse, with your family, with the people that you work with on a day-to-day basis, how you feel when you look on social media at that person whose life is a slow motion car crash, but you follow because of the satisfaction of it. Like, pick who it is that you follow like that. That sensation when you don't just have a stimulus, but you almost draw a connection, you draw a line like a piece of string between yourself and the thing which is happening. that's what it feels like to have a compulsion to be a part of it. And I managed to kind of sever those cords mostly. So a thing occurs, somebody says something on a podcast, or some catastrophe occurs at work, and I'm able to deal with it with more equanimity, which is important, because at the end of the day, that thing's going to happen anyway, and you're going to have to respond anyway. So the problem is not your problem. The problem is your thoughts and feelings about the problem. And therefore, if you can stop the thoughts and feelings, your ability to respond to the problem gets better. It's a wholesale win.
It's an incredibly different way of looking at the world, and incredibly, it's having awareness of the fact rather than just living in it. It's super powerful. One of the things that we have to talk about, because you posted about it on Twitter, was existential risk. And this is something that I don't want to talk about because it scares the living hell out of me. But I think that's more of a reason we have to talk about it. What do most people get wrong about existential risk?
Most people get it wrong. Most people get existential risk wrong in that they don't know what it is. Tighter than that, most people think that climate change is an existential risk priority, which it isn't. I am all for saving the fish and not melting the ice caps, but climate change is not an existential risk priority. Toby Ord, in his book The Precipice, which is the best overview of existential risk out there at the moment, rates the chances that we face an existential risk through climate change over the next 100 years at 1 in 1,000. The likelihood that we face an existential risk from misaligned artificial general intelligence is 1 in 10. From an engineered pandemic is 1 in 30. From an unforeseen anthropogenic risk, which is an unknown unknown basically created by humans, is also 1 in 30. So there should be 100 times the resources and press and person on the front of Time magazine and people knocking holes in Barclays front windows of the bank. There should be 100 times that for artificial general intelligence alignment problems than there are for eco-warrior pursuits. Basically, if we have an unrecoverable loss of human civilization, everything that we value goes out of the window. Anyone that cares about animals and thinks, well, I want to save the whales, we're destroying the planet, you saying that you want to focus on our existential risks is taking priorities away from animals. Well, that would be true if it wasn't for the fact that we're the only ones that can save the animals from inevitable natural risks anyway, because there will be an asteroid or a volcano or the inevitable expansion of the sun, which is going to consume the planet. We're the only ones that can take the genome of those animals and move them to a different planet and actually continue their species. So the book always stops with us. It always ends up being us that has to make things happen, because as wonderful as they are, the bottlenose dolphins and the lions and the tigers and everything else, they can't make spaceships. They can't work out how to step into the programming of what's going on. They are cargo on spaceship Earth, and we are crew. Because we are crew, we are the only ones that can actually step into the programming. Existential risk is the biggest problem that nobody is talking about, and it is literally the only thing anybody needs to be talking about right now. Eliezer Yudkowsky, who's the guy that founded LessWrong.com, his Twitter bio sums it up perfectly. He says, this is the era of misaligned artificial general intelligence, but I tweet about other things anyway. That's it.
How do you fear dying? Because with all this talk about existential risk, is there some part of you that fears one of those situations wiping you personally out?
For me, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think that we're going to, during our lifetime, 100 years, 1 in 10, yeah, I'm 33, I'm probably all right. My kids might have something to worry about. So personally, I don't. I would say that as I strip away more ego, I can see myself getting more and more into the social movement of making existential risk a cultural priority. I can definitely see that as a direction for me in future. I've never really got behind a thing like that. I believe in personal agency and sovereignty of the individual and upward mobility and empowering people to do what they can do. So social causes, I always tend to kind of steer clear of. I'm not like I don't want animals in factory farms to be mistreated, but I'm not massive. I'm not hugely sort of vegan and animal focused. I don't want the ice caps to melt, but I'm not behind Greta Thunberg and following her on Instagram and seeing what she's getting up to. But the first thing I've had a compulsion to support is existential risk. And it wouldn't surprise me if when the podcast game, when I get to where I want to with regards to podcasting, that is a pivot that I make, or maybe I do that en route, or maybe I start to do that in parallel.
Yeah, and I definitely want to get to the podcast. But before that, I want to ask about Toby Ord. He's the author of The Precipice. What's a question that you're dying to ask Toby Ord?
Oh my God. It would be everybody that I want to ask from the Future of Humanities Institute, which is where him and Nick Bostrom and Anders Sandberg and all of the people that are at the forefront of working out how we might destroy ourselves and how to stop it from happening. The thing that I think they're all missing is how to make this a cultural priority. And I would ask them, what can I do, given my platform, given the position that I'm in, what can I do to make your work easier? What can I do to influence cultural opinion so that people are thinking about this in a real, visceral way? If we knew that there was an asteroid headed for Earth in 100 years' time that could wipe all of us out, and maybe it was going to hit us, there was a 1 in 10 chance that it was going to hit us, the entire world would stop. We would, trade wars would have ceased. We would be in collaboration with Russia and China. We would be coming up with lasers to push it off task. We'd get every person that we could who has an appropriate capability, they would be brought to it. But because artificial general intelligence doesn't have that same obvious trajectory of coming towards us, it's difficult to see. People don't understand what it is. There's been far too much Hollywood about it, which makes people think that Arnold Schwarzenegger is going to come down naked and he's going to start beating everybody up, and that's not the way it works. That doesn't help us. So what can I do? Toby, Nick, what would you say that I can do? And then more generally, what can we do? What should society be doing? Because I think that that's what we're missing. These guys are doing amazing work. And for those of us that have taken the existential red pill, I think we understand just how important it is. But there has to be a reason why other people aren't. Maybe it's simply that not enough people are talking about it. But Nick Bostrom went on Rogan, you know? Like, he went on, it was terrible, but he went on Joe Rogan. So I don't know, I'd ask them that. I'd ask them, how can we make this more of a priority culturally?
When you say artificial general intelligence, what exactly does that mean?
A artificial intelligence which is greater than human level intelligence and is able to do recursive self-improvement. So it can program itself to become better. And what happens is you get an intelligence explosion. So it runs away with itself. As it is the best programmer on the planet, it can reprogram itself to be the better, best programmer on the planet, which so on and so forth, it continues up. The problem with that is that if you have something which is essentially unlimitedly powerful, and you don't specify very, very, very perfectly what you want it to do, it can do the thing that you wanted it to do, but just slightly to the left of that, and totally annihilate the planet. So for instance, Nick gives this example where he says, a company that makes paperclips creates an artificial general intelligence, which is able to do recursive self-improvement. It's super intelligent. It runs away with itself. It's basically got the entire world at its disposal. And they say, make as many paperclips as you can. Now, that's a very unbounded command. So it thinks, right, okay, well, I'll start to turn all this metal into paperclips. Then it looks at all the buildings that we live in and it thinks, well, those atoms could be reconfigured to be turned into paperclips. And then it looks at us and thinks, well, actually, all of these humans, they're kind of taking up all of this space and all of these resources that I could be using on turning things into paperclips. Plus, they might turn me off. They might try and turn me off. So I'd better make sure that they can't turn me off, and I'd better turn them into paperclips. And then before you know it, the entire universe is paperclips, because you have this ostensibly a stupid god just doing one thing. So the artificial general intelligence that's superhuman would be phenomenal if we can align what it does with what we want. And that's what's referred to as the alignment problem. And that is the challenge of AI safety.
It's big stuff. It's crazy stuff. And it reminds me of this. I can't remember where I heard it. Maybe you'll know. But someone had the hypothesis of like, imagine if we could clone monkeys and the program was to clone a million monkeys or a billion monkeys. And all of a sudden we got a billion monkeys on our hand and we have no way of reversing it. And the monkeys all want to attack us. It sounds exactly like that.
Nightmare.
Right?
Planet of the Apes turned haywire.
Yeah. And it's just like, we have to make sure that it's not reversible. Like we can reverse the decisions we make rather. And any idea on how to do that as just a fellow podcaster?
Yes. So the best solution for this is given by Nick Bostrom in his book, Superintelligence. And it's called machine extrapolated volition. So what you do is you use the power of the superintelligence against itself. So its alignment or its command that you give it, the outcome you want from it is, what would I ask for if I knew what I wanted? So basically, you get it to create its own outcome function based on what it works out that we would have wanted if we had all of the information at our disposal. So you allow it to fill in the gaps in our ignorance. That's the only compelling. I mean, the alternative is basically to plug holes in the hull of the ship as you try and specify a thing, but then get it slightly wrong. And you go, right, okay, well, I'll patch that by saying, yeah, but not that one. Yeah, but not that. Yeah, but don't turn the dogs into paperclips. Yeah, but don't turn the buildings into paperclips. Yeah, but don't turn us. And you just get this runaway. So you need something more scalable than that. Because when you're talking about what is essentially infinities in terms of power, it needs to be something which is more robust.
Going back to you now, and we've spoke about, or I've heard you speak about how you figured out what you wanted to want. And that plays nicely with what you just said. But my question to you is, what do you do when what you want to want actually changes?
So working out what you want is a question introduced to me by Kyle Eschenroder last year. I found this blog post. He's amazing. You should all go and read it. Just Google, what do you want to want, Kyle Eschenroder. What you realize first is that a lot of the things that you thought you wanted to want aren't what you wanted to want at all. What you wanted to want is actually what your parents wanted you to want, or what society told you you wanted to want, or maybe what your genetic programming, or the way that you dealt with past traumas, or any one of a number of other million things that aren't you, are not your choice. And then you look at, well, I've always thought I wanted a Lamborghini, but actually, why? Like, let's think about the price I'd have to pay. I'd have to work all of these hours and I'd have to accumulate all of this money. And maybe I wouldn't get to spend any spare time with my family or my friends or whatever. Do I actually want? Oh, well, it turns out that I only wanted the Lamborghini because other people wanted the Lamborghini. So it was a social norm. Or maybe it's that I always wanted to be a party boy because I wanted to go out around town. Well, maybe that's just because I have some abandonment issues with an early boyfriend or girlfriend, and I constantly want to feel like people want me and love me. But if I get rid of that and I work out what I actually want is just one loving partner that I'm with for the rest of my life that I can start a family with, something like that. When what you want changes, that's just growing up. The only difference is that when you grow up and you're constantly in control of your wants, it's you that's choosing. The first time that you go from what you think you want to what you want to want is very uncomfortable, because what you realize is that you've been chasing a dream that wasn't even yours. Let's remember that we are the protagonist, the narrator, illustrator, and author of our lives. And yet we waste our pages by looking over other people's shoulders to plagiarize a tale that isn't even our own. It's our job to decide where we're going in life, what it is that we desire. If we're not free to choose what we want in life, what the fuck are we doing? Like, why are we here? So when you do that, you may feel uncomfortable because you think, oh, I thought I really wanted to be successful in business. And now it turns out that I just want to have a family. And maybe that's a bit lame because I'm a guy and like maybe I'm a good looking dude. And I've got all of these friends who are really materialistic and they're bothered about money and girls in the gym and stuff like that. And I just really want to be an awesome dad. Or I just really want to be a great son for my parents as they grow older. I really want to be, or the other way around, like I'm from a small town that really, it's super conservative and everybody's kind of really religious. And I just want to go places. I want to learn stuff. I want to build businesses and invest in new startups that I think are really exciting. That's the uncomfortable thing. After that, it's just a case of going, okay, what's my inner truth look like? And not wishy-washy, ephemeral, new age bullshit. Like, what does the inner voice inside of me genuinely want? And I'll just continue to be drawn by that. And if you're accurately able to tap into that, and this is one of the reasons why meditation is so important, because you've got to dampen down the noise in your mind. When you haven't boiled off all of the sauce, it's really hard to see what you actually want, because this thing pops up and you're like, hang on, is that me? Or is that just a passing thought? You go, no, yeah, that was bullshit. That doesn't really matter. But it's quite hard. So you need to turn the volume down in your mind, work out what you want. And then when that changes, make a decision. Okay, like, I thought this relationship with this guy was really good for me, but I kind of, maybe it doesn't feel that way anymore. Fine, because it's your truth. It is the truth. It's what you actually want. So just make the changes.
That's super helpful for a podcaster as well, right? When you are approaching a conversation, you need to be able to pop out your own voice. Your own voice has to be dulled so that you can truly hear the other person. Has that been useful for your podcasting as well?
Massively. When you have a conversation with someone and you're trying to make it as purposeful as possible, you need to get out of your own way. So I've got Jordan Peterson on the show tomorrow. From when we're recording this, he's coming on tomorrow night, 24 hours from now-ish, I'll be speaking to him. I need to get the fuck out of my own way, because I don't have enough extra bandwidth to be able to deal with what he's going to say if I've still got 25% of my brain going, you know, Jordan's room's interesting, and look at that piece of art over the far side, and oh, I wonder if that shirt's blue or if it's actually gray, and I wonder if he's eaten today, and blah, blah, blah. Shut up. Shut the fuck up. Like, I need to focus on what this guy is saying to me. So, yeah, very much. If you want to have focus, and this is the clarity and concentration element of the meditation we were talking about earlier on, you need to be able to just dampen down all of the other bullshit. Vast majority of stuff that pops up in your mind is pointless, and getting rid of it's a good idea.
Okay, so big guest Jordan Peterson's coming on the podcast. Congratulations on that. What do you do to prepare for that?
With Jordan, it's easy because he's doing the rounds at the moment. He's going on other shows. I listen to him on other shows. I think, wow, that was really good by this person, or that was really terrible by this person, or that was a good point. I wish you'd gone deeper into that. You don't necessarily need to read the book. You don't need to read more rules, 12 more rules. You can just listen to him on other shows and get a conception of where he's going. I quite like to try and ask unique questions of the guests. It's difficult sometimes, especially if someone is doing the rounds. Douglas Murray last year did a lot of shows around the release of the paperback version of The Madness of Crowds. And I was very conscious that I wanted to ask questions that didn't just sound like a British accent version of everybody else's questions. And this comes back to your truth again as well. If you want to be a really good podcaster or a good content creator, the easiest way to find a competitive advantage is to produce what only you can produce. There is only one of you. There's only one person with your genetic code and your life experiences. And there will only ever be one, ever. When you put your foot into a running river, the river's never the same twice. And this is precisely the same with this. Nobody else has that. So why compromise anything? Naval Ravikant says, no one can beat you at being you. You can escape competition through authenticity. So tomorrow, when I'm having this conversation with Jordan, I'm quite an existential guy. Like, I've been through bouts of depression and stuff like that in the past. And it means that I'm able to ask questions about, like, really painful, uncomfortable things about people facing unremarkable depression. Like, one of the things I'm going to bring up is the shame of being depressed about nothing. So if anyone that's listening has ever had that, someone says, why do you feel depressed? And you say, I don't know, just fucking existence. Just the sheer weight of being a human is painful. And that's not celebrated. There's no glory associated with it. There's no breakdown. There's no needles lying in the corner. There's nothing. Okay, so like, how can people pull themselves out of that? But the only way that I can ask that question is because I've been through that situation. So it's allowing me to use my experience, because very few other people relatively in the podcasting world can ask that because it's such a unique situation to have been in.
Only asking what you personally can bring to the table. That's important and powerful. What feeling do you get when you ask someone like Jordan Peterson or any other guest a question and they say, you know what? I've never thought about it that way. What's the feeling that you personally get?
So it's satisfying. It is good. One thing I'm very conscious of is you can chase that too much. That satisfaction that you get of coming at something from left field that the guests never thought of before can actually end up with you constantly trying to do that. And that doesn't always necessarily make for the best conversation. I learned this from Jason Calacanis, actually, that he says a lot of the questions that he asks, he already knows the answer to. And the guest might think, well, this is a fucking stupid question. But it's not just a conversation. It's a performance to bring the audience along with you. So you need to think, okay, do we need to define our terms before we get started here? What do you mean by existential risk? What do you mean by artificial general intelligence? What do you mean by depression? Like, these are the sort of things that you need to do. So it's great when you do that. Brian Greene, the physicist, just tweeted me and said that he really enjoyed this wide-ranging conversation. That guy broke the internet on Rogan last year. He is a titan. He was nearly awarded the Nobel Prize and he's done like Nova miniseries. It's cool to see that, but that's not necessarily, it's the mind's so slippery, man. The mind is so fucking slippery. And it comes back to what we were saying before, that your motivations around what it is that you want, there's always little things taking you off track because you're like, well, maybe all that I need to do to prepare for Jordan Peterson is just think of the weirdest, most left field questions that I can come up with. And then I'll just get constant, but that's not necessarily, is that what you want? No, it's not. You want the most insightful, the best conversation that you can get. So this happens with people all the time. Like, perfect example would be an athlete on the sports field. So this athlete on the sports field knows that if he gets a highlight reel goal or the walkaway knockout in an MMA ring, that it's going to go viral, it's going to make him feel cool. But then he's optimizing for the wrong thing. You're not supposed to optimize for that. That's supposed to be a byproduct of you going towards what you actually want, which is to win the fight or to perform as well as you can for the team or to stick to the tactics or to do whatever the goal is within that particular field of play. So you need to be very careful because fucking desires are a slippery bastard, man, and they will distract you all the time.
And you could think you have it figured out, right? Like, oh, I want to have great conversations with people. And all of a sudden I find myself saying, I want to be the number one podcast in the world. And then I'm like, wait, is that actually what I want? And you constantly have to be checking yourself nonstop.
Yep.
It's crazy. One of the things that I've noticed you do on podcasts, and you haven't done it so far, but you tend to turn it around, turn the podcast, or you're the guest, and then you start asking the host questions about themselves and they start saying, what the hell? You did that to Michael Malice. You did that to Chrissy Mayer, I believe. And I'm just watching a therapy session for them.
Don't worry. It's coming. It's coming, man. It's coming. Don't worry.
So what goes into your mind when you're having these conversations and you're the guest, but your curiosity is coming through?
It's just allowing whatever it is that I want to know in that moment to come up. Somebody asks an interesting question about why do you think this thing, or do you, it's usually when there's a proposal or some sort of proposition, actually. So here is a thing and this is a thing and this is what's happening and why do you think that is? And I'll say, well, actually, like, I think, why do you think it is? Like, what's your opinion on this? Because a lot of the time the people I'm speaking to are far smarter than me. Like, especially coming at it from a podcaster's perspective, man, you can have a speciality within one particular domain. Rogan's fantastic within MMA and comedy. Like, really, he hasn't got many other specialities. Like, he's good at history and he understands some stuff to do with that, and health and fitness he's all right with. But he's just a facilitator. He's just a stage for the people to come out on. So a lot of the time, especially when you're being podcasted as a podcaster, it's a very interesting situation to be in because all that you're ever really doing is repurposing what other people have said to you. all the best insights that I have, or maybe not that, maybe 90% of the best insights that I have are just shit that other people far smarter than me have said to me. And then I'm like, right, okay, I'm just going to turn this back around and then give it to someone. So yeah, it's just following on with that curiosity, allowing that to be the driving force. It ends up being good conversations. Here's an interesting thing. So for the people that aren't podcasters, which is most of the audience that are listening, when you're having a conversation with someone and they say something, if you want them to clarify what they mean, or if you actually genuinely take interest in what that person's talking about, you'll find yourself compulsively asking more and more questions. Okay, so why do you feel like that? Where's that come from? Okay, so who taught you that? Or why did you learn that thing? Or why do you think that is? All of these sorts of questions, they benefit you as the recipient far more than you saying some sort of a response to the person, because you know all of the things that you're going to say, and you know essentially none of the things that that person's going to say. So bizarrely, being selfless in a conversation is one of the most selfish things that you can do. You get to just absorb all of this shit. So me and George McGill are away in Dubai in November last year. We were sat around this pool party. It's like 1 a.m. in the morning. It's Dubai. It's warm. There's like girls in maxi dress, like classic Dubai thing. Everyone's got bright white teeth and like tans and like half a sleeve tattoo. And we're sat there, and separately, two people say the same thing to both of us. They both stopped the conversation and were like, why are you asking me so many questions? And that taught me so much. Taught me so much, because the first thing it highlighted was that it's a rarity for the person that you're speaking to actually be interested in what you're saying. The vast majority of people treat conversations as a tennis match where you get to finish saying the thing that you're saying. And right, has he finished? Right, okay, now I get to hit the ball back across the net. It's my turn to hit it. And it had stood out like such a sore thumb that me and George were asking people questions that they had to call it out. They had to break the fourth wall of the conversation to say, why are you asking me so many questions? One girl actually said the words, stop podcasting me, to me. And I was like, you are aware that all I'm doing is just asking you about your job. She was like, I work in this, I'm kind of like an on my feet receptionist that's really, like really pretty, that works for this big high-flying CEO, and he takes me into meetings as a PA, but also kind of basically a bit of eye candy to distract the other high-flying CEOs so that he looks cool. And I was like, fuck, that is so interesting. So tell me, like, what do you do? So you're in a meeting, do you ever contribute, and do you this, this, and this? And I'm just like, I just want to know what this girl's got to tell me about, because it's a cool story and it's interesting. Stop podcasting me. And I laughed and I was like, you do know I'm just asking you questions. She's like, yeah, I know, but like, it's different. It's weird. And I'm like, well, that's because most people just want to talk about themselves.
Do you think it's because you were forcing her to confront in that moment what she was putting off? You were acting as that awareness for her in that moment?
Very much so. Most people aren't metacognizant about things. They don't ask a question about what's happening. They just have the thing that happens. But to anybody that's got a loud inner monologue, you know that basically you want to desperately get yourself out of that metacognizance and just into the moment. You're like, I fucking wish that I could stop thinking about thinking. I just want to think. I just want to experience. I just want to be on the roller coaster, not consider whether or not that thing that my dad said to me on the way to cricket when I was 17 years old actually means something, blah, blah, blah. Like, just calm the fuck down. So, yeah, very much so.
So I brought up the Chrissy Mayer podcast you were on before, and I was doing research by listening to that for this conversation, and you brought up Tiger Woods and how there's a price to pay to be Tiger Woods. And it was such a fascinating concept because I never thought about it that way. And I'd love to understand, what's the price to pay to be Chris Williamson?
That's a really good question. So for anyone that doesn't understand the background you've just given there, anybody that's successful, you are looking at their success within a very narrow domain. You are looking at Tiger Woods' ability on the golf field. But what's the price that Tiger Woods needs to pay to be Tiger? He was abused racially with his dad as a kid. His dad and him even had a safe word like you do during rough sex, which they called the E word, enough. He has had the most publicized failed marriage in history. He was chased down the driveway by his wife wielding a golf club. He fell asleep on the side of the road because he was on antipsychotics. He's just rolled his car. He's spent half a decade out of the sport due to injury, all this sort of stuff. But no one actually sees that bit. No one sees the bit of Tiger Woods' performance that isn't the thing that we celebrate. And because we applaud success in this meritocracy world that we have, the capitalist society in 2021, we applaud success so much that we're happy to forgive someone's failings for as long as they're spectacular in one area of life. And the price that you need to pay in order to achieve that level of spectacularness is often something that most people wouldn't. You love the idea of being Elon Musk, but Elon might have not had an erection in months because he's so stressed with SpaceX and Tesla and driving cars to Mars and stuff like that. Like that's the price that you need to pay to be Elon Musk. So do you want to be Elon Musk? Do you really want to do a wholesale 24/7 swap with that person? You can't just have the success of Tesla and being able to do cool dances in China without having the terrible relationship with your body, without having the mind that can never shut off. And it may be fucking brilliant being Elon, I don't know. But my point is that there are always externalities. The price that it is to be me, the price that you have to pay to be Chris Williamson, is someone whose mind doesn't quieten very much. It's always on. It feels like when I wake up on a morning, someone just turns this volume knob up in my head and it doesn't stop for the rest of the day. I'm thinking about a thing, I'm ruminating, I'm reflecting on stuff. There's some elements, the insights that I get, which I think are sometimes novel and sometimes useful and sometimes help people, they come from a place of childhood insufficiency, really unpopular as a kid, bullied quite badly in school. I didn't sound like the people that were from the area that I was from in the UK. I went to a state primary, state secondary, state sixth form college. So I was around people who weren't going to go to university, but that was what I wanted to do. And I didn't sound the same and I didn't act the same and so on and so forth. And I think that wrote into my source code a desire to want to be liked by people. A big part of, I think, why I'm driven to do stuff is just out of fear of insufficiency. That maybe when I'm this successful, I'll finally be worthy of love and praise and admiration. And even saying this, even breaking it down in this way, makes people feel uncomfortable because most of us don't operate in this metacognizant way. We don't operate by knowing why we do the things we do, or at least having a theory about them. We just are the way that we are. Like we're not all our own therapists, you know? But I am. I very much am my own therapist. And I love the insights that I get. I really do. But there is a price to be paid for that. It's both a blessing and a curse to feel everything so very deeply. And the depth of your consciousness causes you to suffer. As you become more aware and more nuanced around what it is that you're doing, why the motivations are there, would ignorance be bliss? Would it be better for me to not know why I have the compulsions that I do to do the things that I do? Might be. Would everybody? Sometimes it's quite ugly to know what, because a lot of the time the motivations you have actually come from a place that's not very admirable, or maybe it's not very gracious or graceful to actually think about the fact that me doing things for other people perhaps is because I desperately want them to like me, not because I'm just a nice person. Or the reason that you're so into the gym is because deep down you actually don't find yourself attractive, or whatever it might be. There are a million different reasons about why you do things, about the fact that you're so loyal to your boyfriend because fundamentally you don't think that anyone wants you, not that you're actually a loyal girlfriend to him. Like, these things are uncomfortable truths to come up against, but I adore finding them out. I think that if you were to go through life without working out why you're here, like fundamentally, psychologically, what it is that causes you to do the things you do, the curiosity for me is stronger than the fear of finding out. So the curiosity tends to win.
It's Deep stuff. That's very deep stuff, my man. So your voice doesn't turn off in your head. And when do you find that level of silence, if ever?
When I'm engaged in doing something. So I'm not thinking now. I'm not thinking when I'm having this conversation with you. The words are just coming out of my mouth. There's some silence when I read. There's some silence when I watch TV. There's silence when I find flow in doing sports. I'm big into athletics and stuff like that. And I like to when I do, when I've got two ankles, which I don't quite now, but yeah, it's difficult. And this year has been particularly difficult, especially for the other introverts that are listening. You haven't had the usual distractions that would have taken you out of your own head. I drove to a place called Leeds, which is about an hour and a half away from me in the UK. I drove there yesterday and I swear to God, it felt like a holiday. I was like, wow, this is what the outside world feels like. Because I've just been in my house for months, you know, just leading this weird down-regulated life. So yeah, it's, I think that's one of the reasons that I love podcasting, that it does cause that silence to be there. I had a conversation with a guy called Paul Bloom, who's a psychologist from Yale. He's been on Sam Harris's podcast a million times. And he spoke to a dominatrix woman that does rough sex for money. And she gave him this quote that said, "Nothing captures attention like a whip." And what she means by that is that if you're slapped in the face for a brief period, maybe 5 seconds or so, you're not thinking about anything. You're just thinking, hang on, did I just get slapped? She just slapped me. And people chase that silence. What does Naval say? He says, we don't want peace of mind, we want peace from mind. Why do people love doing free solo rock climbing or base jumping? It's because it's a forcing function that causes their mind to have to quiet, because the problem, if they don't, the risk if the mind isn't quiet is so grave that it has to do it. It thinks, right, I'm falling off the side of a cliff with like some squirrel wingsuit attached to me. I need to funnel my focus. And it causes the mind to be silent. I think the vast majority of the things that we do, why do people go to nightclubs, the collective effervescence of everybody dancing together with a little bit of alcohol to dampen down what's going on, and your friends and the music, and it's just you and it, and you're not thinking about anything else. A lot of the things that we do in life, I think, can be tracked back to us just trying to find peace from mind. It just happens to be that we have a predilection toward different things. For someone, it might be rough sex. For someone, it might be reading. It might be art. It might be music. It might be playing music. It might be DJing. It might be making cocktails behind a bar and bottle flaring. Like, it could be sex. It could be your family. It could be play with the kids. It could be anything. We're trying to find peace from mind for the most part.
It's so interesting because a partier, someone who's going out to drink, someone who's taken psychedelics, a monk, they're all chasing the same feeling, which is exactly what you were talking about, which is absurd to think about, but so true. In that, you mentioned being an introvert, and that would surprise a lot of people considering you speak to people, podcasting 3 times a week. How did you come to the conclusion that you were an introvert, and how is that possible with you podcasting and talking to people and exploring a personality that's so real 3 times a week?
The definition that I give to introversion and extroversion in this context, being an introvert is getting energy from spending time on your own. Being an extrovert is getting energy from spending time with other people. It's not about, are you charismatic or can you work a group? I don't think that that is an effective definition. Much more effective definition is, where do you recharge your batteries? Does it feel exhausting to spend 5 hours in a group having a barbecue or at a party or at a conference or at work, constantly talking to people? Do you need to go home and think, oh God, sit down and just put some YouTube on or read a book or have some food or walk the dog? That to me is introversion. Is the converse correct? If you're forced to be in the house and do some work or sit in a cubicle and crack on, do you need to get out and talk to people and speak to your wife or speak to your friends or do whatever? That's extroversion as far as I'm concerned. It's a much more flexible definition because it permits people to be able to do things that are extroversion characteristics, be charismatic, be communicating well, be outgoing. Like, don't forget, man, I've stood in the door of 1,000 club nights. I've watched 1 million drunk people go into them. So I know how to have a conversation with people. I was exhausted once I'd done it. When I got home from work, I'm like, oh my God, I've spoken to 2,500 people that have walked past me on the door and half of them know me. So I'm like, hey, mate, how are you doing? Hey, darling, how are you doing? Hey, mate, how are you doing? I used to have this rule where if me and the other managers that worked for me had come home and you didn't have makeup on both shoulders of your jacket, you hadn't worked hard enough, because when girls sort of give you a hug, the little bit of their makeup comes off. So it's kind of like the, I guess it must be the same in baseball. If you go home and your whites are dirty, then it means that you've had a good game. Whereas if you go home and they're clean, then you probably didn't work hard enough. So that was kind of the same for us. Yeah, man, it's the introversion extroversion thing, I think, can be a limiting label. A lot of people are very capable introverts or are very productive extroverts. It's all about where you get your energy from. What would you say that you are?
I would say I'm 50-50 split. I think that I get energy from books. I get energy from this conversation. So that's how I would characterize myself. But back to you, you mentioned in that conversation with Michael Malice that you felt a sense of identity to working hard and to standing out at those club nights. And if you didn't have that makeup, you wouldn't feel like you did a good job. How exactly did you get over that?
That's a difficult one. So the Puritan work ethic, which is built into the source code of the meritocracy capitalist world that we're in, right? That you can imagine these monks in the Middle Ages or these priests, and they're hoeing the gardens and the sun's beating down on their back, and they're doing it just in service to God. They're just here, they're performing these acts simply for his, capital H, his glory, right? Roll that forward now. People still celebrate hard work just because. Shortcuts are seen as kind of like a cheater's way out. It's only now when you see people like Naval really breaking down leverage to first principles and saying, okay, how much can you get out of how little input? That is not something to be snarked at. That's not you taking a shortcut. That's you being efficient. And it takes a counterculture revolution for things like that for people to actually give themselves license to actually not feel like that. Anyone that is a young businessman or girl who has been attached to their work will know the feeling of being successful, but it having it come too easily. And if that happens, you almost feel guilty, because very quickly you associate your sense of success with how much you've suffered, not with the outcome from the event. And if success comes too easily, you always feel like there's this headroom above you. You're like, well, if I'd suffered more, maybe the success would have been more, because you associate success with suffering. And that's something a whole bunch of my buddies have gone through. And it's a really, really vicious cycle, because it's very hard to extract yourself out of that. And yeah, I'm very glad that I did. It took a long time. It took a very, very long time for me to realize that success can just be success. It doesn't have to hurt. It doesn't necessarily have to hurt. You can hurt in the things that you want to hurt, but here's another thing, actually, I've been thinking about a lot recently. When does development stop when we're talking about someone that's growth-minded? So everybody at the moment is trying to better themselves. I'm trying to become the Cal Newport deep work, James Clear atomic habits, David Allen getting things done monstrosity that I can. I want to do all of these things. But there has to come a point where you stop developing and just start exploiting. Like, if you look to your granddad's not really too fussed about acquiring new skills. He's just happy to do what he can with the things that he can. And the same goes for someone, I actually think, like Rogan and these guys that are maybe a little bit further along. They're another half a generation ahead of where we are. And they don't necessarily seem to have this compulsion to acquire new skills. They're just refining the ones that they've got. And this is a question for everybody that's growth-minded or in the productivity world at the moment. When is enough enough? Like, when are you going to consider that you have sufficient skills that you can kind of just go, okay, I can just focus on what I'm good at and I can get better at those, as opposed to this lackluster, I feel like I'm not enough, I need more skills, I need more talents. Do you feel that? Do you know the compulsion that I mean?
100%. But with that being said, what you're talking about is reminding me so much of a conversation I had with Gay Hendricks. Do you know who Gay Hendricks is? He's a psychologist who's worked, he's probably 80 years old and just such a wise, loving man. And when I spoke to him, he broke it down life in two phases. Before you get to 40 and after 40. And he said, when you're before 40, you're trying to gain as much as possible. Exactly what you're talking about. After 40, people like Rogan and others, it's like they're giving away almost. They're giving everything they've gained. You look at Rogan, what is he doing? He's putting up a platform for younger comics. When he's at jiu-jitsu, he's probably teaching people the skills that took him so long to learn. So I thought that was a fascinating way to break it down and gave me some level of calmness about all the gaining that I'm trying to do. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, man. Yeah, it's interesting as well. It's so interesting to see what happens, what will happen when we get to their age, when we get to sort of the 50s and 60s age. I think there was a big inflection point between our parents' generation and ours. Everybody that's listening has had to teach their mum or dad to use the iPad or to do something on the internet because there was such a right turn, such a big difference between what they had experienced and the rules that they knew and what we've experienced. And now the roles have been reversed. Typically, the elders would have been the one that held the wisdom. Why do you respect your elders? Because they're the ones that only know anything. All of the young people, they can only get little slivers of information because information and knowledge wasn't widespread and it wasn't frictionlessly available to everybody. Whereas now, your ability to develop is constrained purely by the speed at which you can acquire information and learn. The fastest learners are the smartest people on the planet, not the oldest ones now. In fact, the oldest ones are the ones that maybe they need to learn from the younger people. But I think that's potentially going to change at least a little bit in part now. And it'll be interesting to see the gap between our generation and our kids' generation and to say, okay, so is it coming back now? Are we the ones that are still teaching when they're 25 years old and they're running a business? Are they coming to us for advice or are we just watching from the stands and going, what on earth is he doing?
Because the internet, right? The internet was the great disruptor that allowed free access and information to everyone, which made the quickest learners the smartest people in the world. But my question about the elders, I want to go back to that. Do you think in the UK where you're at, is there a sense that the elders don't belong? Is there a sense of like, oh, you know, do you feel, how is the elders in the UK?
I think that there's a bit of a fish out of water mentality. It's uncomfortable, man. It's uncomfortable having knowledge that people older than you don't. There's no cultural archetype for this. Not yet, I don't think. You know, the 21-year-old upstart Silicon Valley multimillionaire, people marvel at it because it's so freakish. Because we always presumed for years and years and years that the people who had the most money and the most experience and the most wisdom were the older ones. And don't get me wrong, there's older people that are sharp as hell. I mean, you just got to look to the Rogans and the Petersons and such like. But then you also have these young kids that are freaks, that are absolute animals. I mean, George Max, 24, 25. And this guy, I sit and listen to him in Dubai just talking about stuff. And he's such a unique and original thinker. But that's not been cultivated over time. That's innate. It's like it's got high velocity. It's in motion. You know, he's moving fast. He hasn't acquired momentum. He's just got a really big engine inside of him. What about America? Like, do you see this in America as well? Is the older generation and the younger generation, is there a divide?
I would say that older people feel that they're not included in what's going on. And it's so odd because this is not the way that it's always been. And I think our programming as people is to give respect to the older generation. But for some reason, technology, likely, it's like they're on their own. And it shouldn't be that way, in my personal opinion. And I think that we need to do and take steps to include them and to bring them closer. Do you have any idea on how to do that?
I think that's a great insight to say that they're almost not a part of the discussion anymore. We've bifurcated civilization in a way, at least in the West. You've got the people that are part of the meme culture, that are on Twitter, that understand about how trends are working, and then you have the people that don't. And it very much is a two-sided discussion like that. To bring those people back into the discussion, man, time is going to continue moving forward in any case. So very slowly, you are going to turn into your parents no matter what you want. This is the hilarious thing about young liberals, that every young liberal is just a conservative that hasn't grown up yet. Look to every time that there's a British general election, young people share the graph that says, look at all of these people over the age of 50, 60, and 70 that are voting conservative. They're wasting our future. I'm like, that's you. That's you in 20 years' time. You're talking to yourself. Like, can't you see this? It's so short-sighted to believe that you're not going to be that person in the future. Of course it's going to be you. But do you think there was just a wave of conservatism that was born 50, 60, 70 years ago, and now there's a wave of liberalism? No, obviously not. Look back to the 60s and you had the peace movement and you had Woodstock, and then look to the 70s and you had every single time people get to their 20s and they think that they know everything that's going on, and then they get to their 50s and they just don't want things to change. This is the way that it happens for the vast majority of us. And to think that you are exceptioned to this rule is just wrong.
My dad likes to say, you go to college to become liberal and you start paying taxes to be conservative. That's just how the world works. And bang, he's been saying it for a decade. So respect, you hit the nail on the head there. So, you know, one thing our culture doesn't think a lot about is death. And we've touched on it with existentialism. We've touched on it with talking about elders, but how do you think about death?
Death to me is an interesting question, because I've got quite a small family. I'm an only child. I've got mum and dad who are both still here. So I've never had to deal with anyone close to me dying. Like, either my mum or my dad are going to pass away first, and I'm not going to have any experience in having lost someone that's close immediate family. So it's going to be hard. I think that reminding ourselves that life is short is important. Reminding yourselves that even if you live for 90 years, there's just not that many years. There's just not that much time. There's certainly not enough time to spend 2 hours a day on TikTok. There's certainly not enough time to spend hours and hours of the day consumed by thoughts that you didn't choose, or living a life that society says that you should, or your parents say that you should. Because in a very, very real sense, the only reason that we are here is to live a life which, in retrospect, we are glad that we lived. If you look back and you're not happy with how you spent your time, that is a life poorly lived, as far as I'm concerned. So what do you want to do? How do you want to spend your time? Genuinely, you have the entire world at your disposal. Yes, sure, there's some financial constraints. And yes, sure, there might be some responsibilities. But you have far more control over the day-to-day existence that you go through than you think, and that you might consider. So how do you want to do it? Genuinely, ask yourself, what would a good life look like to you? If you were to look back in 50 years' time and look at how you spent your time, what would have had to have happened for you to look back and consider it a success? That question is unbelievably hard to answer. It is mind-bendingly difficult to answer, because you're forced then to think, okay, what do I genuinely care about? Am I going to look back in 50 years' time and be thankful for all the fast cars that I bought? Am I going to look back in 50 years' time and be thankful for how quickly I responded to my DMs? Play stupid games, win stupid prizes. What's the prize for being the fastest email replier in the office? What's the prize for being the person who's always online? What's the prize for only sleeping 6 hours a night, other than Alzheimer's 10 years earlier? Like, there is no prize. What would a good life look like to you? It's a very difficult question to answer. And reminding yourself that life is short is a very good way to add some urgency to it. In fact, one of the questions that I have for Jordan tomorrow is, life is short, how can we add a sense of urgency to it? And I'll be very interested to hear his response.
What does a life well lived look like for Chris Williamson?
As far as I'm concerned at the moment, I just want to facilitate really interesting insights that I think better people's lives. Right now, I'm not in a position, I'm not changing cultures. I'm just like a tiny little gnat that's on the corner of a very big rocket ship that's going to the moon at the moment, which is the podcasting world. But I genuinely think that you can make impact on people in very profound ways if you're being truthful, if you're exposing them to things that are genuinely good for them, that are reminding them that they can choose their own direction, that there's a bigger world out there than the one that they see. So think about 30 years ago, the secretly gay guy living in an Orthodox Jewish community who had no one, he couldn't connect with anybody, he didn't know he was going to be ostracized by his family. Do I want to repress my sexuality for my entire life and be accepted by family? Or do I want to pursue my sexuality and completely dispense with my family and be, you know, it's really, really difficult, right? Whereas now, you have the opportunity, whatever it is that you want to be, whoever it is that you want to become, you can find other people out there that are going to be able to support you because you have the opportunity to communicate. So for me, facilitating that in the best way that I can, I spent a long time being a very selfish person, like a very, very long time, classic only child, I suppose. And now learning the pleasure that you get from people messaging you or emailing you and saying, hey, man, that podcast has really, it saved bits of me, or it's made me a better person, fundamentally made me a better person. No one ever came out of one of my club nights and walked up to me and said, hey man, you know, before I went in tonight, I was in this dark hole, I was existentially depressed and I was lost and I didn't really feel like anyone got me. But man, when I heard that banging house music and had some of those £1 Jaeger bombs, dude, it really, you got me, man. Thank you, Chris. Thank you so much. I'd never had that, but then I started to get that with the podcast. And that's a good way to look at it, especially for burgeoning content creators. You don't necessarily need to think about the subs count or the play count. If you judge the quality of your content by the number of people that are affected by it, and they'll reach out. If they're sufficiently affected, they'll message you, and you'll have got this. Like if they message, one of those messages to me is worth 10,000 subscribers. And I have a little folder, again, another cool little life hack. Every time I receive one of those, an email or whatever, I take a little screenshot and I just throw it in a folder. And then if I'm ever feeling down or if I'm ever thinking, oh my God, this edit today is taking forever, 6 hours and I've not done any work and I've not done this and it's really hard and I can't get the file to sound right and I can't get the intro and the ad reads correct, and I can just have a little read through that and I think, fuck, look at the impact that it's had. Genuinely, look at the impact that it's had. And I wonder as well, I'm a pretty bad liar, like my ex-girlfriends would attest to this as well. I'm quite a bad liar. It genuinely is me, you know? Like I put myself out there. There is nothing being hidden. And maybe I'd be more effective if I was. I don't know, because we never get to see the inside of Joe Rogan's head. And I'm sure that he'll say that he puts himself out there. But maybe he does cultivate himself in one way or another. Maybe he does distance himself from his emotions. I'm not a sufficiently good liar to be able to do that. So I'm a say. I'm going to tell you, if I've spent days and days in bed just crushed under the weight of existence, I'm going to tell you about the time when I had far too much tequila and couldn't get it up in university and how you can get past the same problem. Well, I'm going to tell you about, do you know what I mean? I am more than happy to do that. And it makes me feel good because it makes me feel connected. When the impact's there, it makes me feel connected. Aubrey Marcus, the CEO of Onnit, told me that the persona is incapable of receiving love. It can only receive praise. Because people aren't in love with you. If you're only playing a role, they're not in love with you. They're just applauding the role that you play. We don't love Russell Crowe, we love Gladiator. We don't love Chris Hemsworth, we love Thor. And this is how you can feel alone in a crowd and hollow in victory. Because you can be surrounded by as many people as you want, but you're gonna feel empty and hollow inside if you're only playing a role. So very, very much so, connecting to something which is true to you, which makes you feel there is a compulsion to do it. You have to do it. You can't not do it. that I think is a life well lived, like just chasing that down. It doesn't mean hedonism. Maybe some other version of a person just wants to sniff lines and fuck bitches. Like, cool, great. Like, more power to you. I guess it's just fortunate that the thing that I feel compelled to do right now is to do something that I genuinely think makes the world a better place. And that's mental as well. Like, how many people have the privilege and the opportunity to look at the things that they do on a day-to-day basis and genuinely believe they're leaving the world better today than they were yesterday because of the thing that they get to do? Like, that's privilege. Forget class hierarchies and racial and gender demographics. That's privilege. But it's a privilege that everybody can have access to. You can make the world a better place. You can be the best son, brother, member of your community, member of your sports team that you can. You can make the people's lives around you better simply by being a better version of a human.
It sounds like you have a tremendous sense of meaning in your own life. How would you recommend someone take those first steps if they feel that they don't have that meaning right now?
To find meaning, you need to work out what your truth is. Because if you're unable to access what you genuinely feel, you're always going to just be pulled along by the different winds of life. You're going to be pulled along by social norms or internal fears or the way that you've dealt with past traumas. And that inevitably is going to cause you to climb up a ladder only to then find out when you get to the top that it's leaning against the wrong wall, which is a very bad situation to be in. So work out what your truth is. What do you genuinely feel? What are you compelled to do? What are your values as a human? I talk a lot about core values. You can Google Taylor Pearson core values exercise. It'll take you half a day if you do it very intensely, and it'll change your life because you will understand the fundamental building blocks that your life is built upon. From there, you go, okay, well, what can I do in my day-to-day existence that facilitates the meaning I want to generate over a long period of time? It's the same way as you create a website or you do any big project. You break the main goal down into micro goals, and then you break the micro goals down into actionable steps, and then you break the steps down into daily actions. Okay, I now have my daily actions. I know that the things that I do each day are contributing to the thing that I genuinely want to want. I want to be curious, I want to have adventure, selfless development, excellence, and self-care. Those are the five things that my life is built upon. So if I know that every day I'm filling the buckets of each of those, I can't go far wrong. And it doesn't matter what flavor that's in. Maybe podcasting only lasts for another couple of years, and maybe I go do some other thing. If it facilitates the values that I have right then, it's going to be fine. So spend some time, work out what your truth is. What is it that you want to want? What are your values in life? How can I ensure that the things that I do on a daily basis contribute to me achieving these values and contributing to these values long-term? I'm going to guess that you've done a core values exercise. What did yours come up with?
I actually haven't, and I'm excited to do one after this episode is over.
It's the most important self-development task that you'll ever do. It really is. It took me a week. He says you can do it in half an hour. It took me a week to do. So take your time over it as well.
Yeah. So when you talk about those specific things, you know, your core values, do you then break those down and say, have I hit this today? Have I made that into a goal and then hit that goal today? How does that work from a micro perspective?
Yeah. So what you can do quite easily is get stuck with these big fluffy notions, right? Curiosity, great. Like, so I'll be curious every day. What's that actually mean? Like, it's not just a word. Like, it needs to be a thing. How can I instantiate this on a daily basis? So once you have your values, once you understand what gives you a sense of meaning in the world, then you need to work out, okay, what can I do on a daily basis that contributes to that? So for me, with curiosity, I want to read. I want to acquire new information. I want to meet new and interesting people. I've programmed curiosity into my world by running a podcast. Adventure, I try and say yes to social events and no to work events as much as possible. I want to discriminate myself towards meeting new and interesting people. The reason that we went to Dubai is because George suggested that we go away somewhere. He woke up the next morning and I was having my PCR COVID swab that was for Fit to Fly. So I was like, dude, I'm gone. Like, I'm there. You don't need to suggest it to me, because I know if I can get over that discomfort of changing location, and it might be expensive, and it might be a little bit awkward, and what about the time zone, and what about the cost of the flights? Once I've done it, I'm like, yes, I know, because I know that adventure is one of my core values. So I can always make a decision in the direction of adventure and feel confident that it's working for me. Selfless development. I know that if I do things every day that are good for me, that make me a better human, that I can then teach those to other people. And I know that that makes me feel good as well. Excellence. I know that if I spend every minute making the most of that minute, I will look back on the day and feel like it was a day well lived. If I spend it wallowing around and scrolling on social media and not really doing stuff, like, sure, that's fine as a break or whatever, but that I know that every minute I do that is taking away from a minute that could be doing something that makes me feel like excellence is manifesting in my life, and that makes me feel satisfied. So you can break it down quite easily. Like, again, the question to ask yourself is, what would have to happen tomorrow for you to look back on tomorrow and consider it that it was a day well spent? Like, genuinely, what would it be? What would have to happen tomorrow for you to look back on tomorrow and consider that it was a day well spent? And that's a hard question to answer. But when you can answer it, to me, I would learn some new things about myself or the world around me. I would improve myself a tiny little bit. I would have a conversation with someone that I thought was fascinating, and I would then deliver that to some people that would then help them to benefit from it. Maybe I'd go somewhere new. Maybe I'd see something different. Maybe I'd try a different type of food. Like, that's really it. Someone else's core values, and mine may change in 5 years' time. Mine may be different, but someone else's core values, they may just adore nature or caring for others. So it might be, right, well, I would take my grandma on a walk, because that's like something that makes me feel good about other people. Maybe it would be sports or fitness. Maybe it would be whatever. Like, those things are fine. You can choose the flavor of what it is that you do, but the vast majority of people just get blown by the wind. They don't actually choose to do anything. When they step out of the door in the morning, if you ask them what they're going to go and do, they just tell you what they're doing, not why they're doing it. Okay, so why are you going to this job? Or why are you doing that gym thing? Oh, well, it's because of that. Okay, dig down, ask why a couple more times. And you just get, it's nothing. It just disintegrates. Because people's daily actions very often aren't aligned with their long-term goals, because they've never worked out their long-term goals.
That is a beautiful, beautiful place to wrap it up, my friend. Is there anything you'd like to add to this conversation? Anything else you'd like to say before we go to a close?
I appreciate you for bringing me on, man. It's been a very, very long time coming. I think what you're doing is fantastic. You're an awesome host. And long may it continue, dude. I appreciate the support that you give online. I love the little community that we've got going on of mindful content creators. And if anybody that enjoyed the episode, if they want to check out the show, it's Modern Wisdom wherever you listen, or Chris Williamson on all social media, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, wherever it might be.
Awesome. All those will be in the show notes. Thank you, Chris, for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, brother. It was a pleasure.
Hey, I just wanted to give you a quick thank you for listening until this moment. I really appreciate it from the bottom of my heart. It means the world to me. And if you enjoyed this episode, it would also mean the world to me if you would pass it along with someone who you believe will find enjoyment in it. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your time. And I'll see you guys in the next one. Peace.